access number 14257, reel 1.
Mr. Raleigh, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
In Goldthorpe, in Yorkshire.
Which year was that?
1926.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a miner at the time.
Did you go to school at Goldthorpe?
Yes, till I was about 8 or 9. And then we moved to Doncaster. My father got a job at what was Bember, the German factory. It's ICI now, in Doncaster, so we moved to Doncaster then.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
15.
So the war had already started?
That's right, yes.
Did you have any reaction to the news that we were at war with Germany, or were you too young?
No, I was, because my brother was in the army at the time. He joined the army at the time of the Munich crisis, and so I was mad keen to get in the army myself, of course. The only way I could get in the army, of course, was to join Boy Service, which I did when I was 16.
In 42?
In 43.
Mm. But how did you feel about the outbreak of war?
Well, I suppose didn't give it too much thought, really, on the political side of things. But I think we more or less thought that we were right by going to war, that we had to go to war.
Were you in any of the early bombing by the German Air Force of Britain?
Not in Doncaster we weren't. We heard the raids going over to Sheffield, of course, and we could often hear the aircraft going over. But when I was down in Woolwich, when I joined the army, I was at Woolwich, and we were in a few raids while I was down there, of course.
Can you describe what it was like in Woolwich under the bombing?
I don't know, I couldn't really explain it. Just one of those things that happened, I suppose. I remember walking up from the theatre one night. I'd been down to the theatre, into Woolwich town itself, and walking back up to camp at night when there was a raid on. And, of course, on the outskirts of Woolwich, one of the Z batteries, where they used to fire these rockets in great, great numbers. And, of course, all that went up had to come down again. And I remember walking up the hill and hearing the shrapnel on the road, which sounded like rather like a heavy hailstorm, all these little bits falling down the road.
Do you remember any particular buildings or streets that were hit in Woolwich?
No, not particularly. The big thing was we were only boys, and we were very rarely allowed out at night. We had one night out a week, which was Wednesday nights. And most, if we went out at weekend, we had to be back in camp by 9 o'clock. So of course, by the time the raid started, we were in barracks, and we had the sports field across. We were in Woolwich Depot, and across the other side of the playground were trenches. When the bombing got anything light, then we had to go and lay in the trenches, cleared the barracks.
Did any bombs fall on the barracks?
Not while I was there, but it had been bombed before I got there, and after I left, the garrison church was hit by a flying bomb, and one of our drum majors was killed in that time.
What was his name?
Can't hear it then.
It doesn't matter.
I'll try and remember his name. But we had ex-boys who served during that time. We formed a sort of organised association, if you like, of ex-boys who were in there at wartime, and we have a relationship, or we did, with the RA boys of now. They've been disbanded now, of course, under the army cuts, and we gave them a few things like drums and trumpets and things like that. And one of them was in recognition of this drum major, who were trumpet majors, we called them. Oh, was.
Were they having a service when the garrison church was
hit? I'm not sure, because I wasn't there at the time, but I know he was killed at that time that the church was hit.
How did you come to be in the Army Air Corps?
Well, I moved down to Lark Hill. I must have gone. I moved down to Lark Hill, and I was reading ACI's Army Council instructions one day. And I must say, at the time, I wasn't particularly keen on staying in the artillery. It seemed to me, as they used to call them, 7 mile snipers, that you weren't going to see much action. This is, as I was thinking in those days, of course, being an artilleryman, you wouldn't see much action there. It would be rather boring. So when I saw this ACI asking for volunteers for the Glider Park Regiment, I volunteered.
Was it easy to get in?
No. I think of the when I went down, we had to go down to London for the interview, and I think there was about a couple of dozens went down there, and I think there were only about four of us who were accepted at that time. And then, of course, that was the easy part, really, because the hard part was when you went down to Fargo Camp, which was on Lark Hill, just down the road from where I'd been stationed, actually. And we had a month chasing around there by sort of senior members of the Glider Park Regiment, mainly ex-guardsmen. Nearly all the warrant officers and senior NCOs were ex-guardsmen, airborne, but ex-guardsmen. And they chased us around, and you were thrown out for the silliest little thing. The idea being that they didn't want people there who joined up to fly. They wanted people who joined up to be soldiers, and flying was going to be incidental. So some people who went with the idea, who sort of transferred to Glider Park Regiment, with the idea that this was the kind of life that the RAF, we thought, and actually Army thought the RAF had a cushy time. If they were going to have that kind of life, they didn't want that. They wanted people who were going to come determined to be soldiers. And that was the main theme right through the glider pilot regiment, was that you were a soldier first and flying was incidental, really. It was like a parachutist. The actual flying part and the parachuting part were just a means of getting you to battle.
Did that philosophy suit you?
Yes, that's why I joined, really. That was the idea.
What was it like learning to fly a glider?
Well, we did Tiger Moths first. We went to EFTS, which was run by the RAF, and we learnt to fly Tiger Moths, and every landing that you did on a Tiger Moth in those days, we had to do a glide landing. You weren't allowed to do power landings. If you used power, once you'd cut the engine to land, then you were scrubbed. That was no good. So you were taught to do glide landings. And then we went to AFTS to fly Hotspurs, and they were quite good in some ways. They're very heavy. The controls were very heavy. But you had quite a bit of responsibility taken away from you, of course, because the chap in front was the one who was going to tell you where you were going. You just hung on the back, and it was up to him to get you to the places where you had to go, kind of thing. So that map reading and that kind of thing didn't come into it too much at that time.
How did the Hotspur handle?
Heavy, very heavy. Very heavy controls. I think originally it had been, when it had been first designed, it had had a larger, slightly larger wingspan than when it actually came into service. But I think that was because with the larger wingspan, it was getting more like your modern sailplanes, and it was staying in the air too long, so they had to chop some of the wing off, so it would be more like a glider than a sailplane. And that, of course, affected it slightly.
How did you like being in a glider? Was it what you expected?
Well, I had no idea what it was going to be like originally, but I enjoyed it. But I wouldn't have liked to sit in the back. It's all right up front flying, but I think sitting in the back was most uncomfortable. And they got the glue, because we were all glued together. And a hot day especially, the smell of the glue. And of course, gliders bobbed around a lot, like a cork on the end of a string. So I reckon after 2 or 3 hours in the back of a glider, you weren't feeling very well.
You got the strong smell of glue?
Yes. They were glued together. And on a hot day, you could smell the glue. Not very nice.
Did it seep onto the passengers?
Onto the passengers, yes. But not the pilots. The pilots didn't feel it.
But the glue actually stuck to their clothing.
I don't know so much if it stuck to their clothing, but you could smell it. The smell was there. Most aircraft smell. I mean, if you get into a modern aircraft, there's a definite smell about it, the leather and the lubricant and the metal and that kind of thing. They have a distinctive smell about them. Not always unpleasant, really, but a glider, back of a glider, certainly was, and especially in hot weather.
Were there any accidents in the training?
We had... let me see. I don't think we had many accidents. We had two incidents in training where the tow ropes were pulled out at the side of the runway, laid out on the grass at the side of the runway. Or if the runway was grass, it was laid alongside so that when the tugs came round to be hooked up, they could just pull the ropes over. And on this particular field, there was a WAF. We had WAFs who were aircraft handlers. And she was pulling the rope out, one of the people in charge pulling the ropes out behind the glider. And as the glider took off, it swung, and the wing hit her behind the head and it killed her. And there's another instance where, nothing to do with gliding really, but a chap came into the air controller's hut at the end of the runway, and some idiot fired a Vary cartridge, hit him smell in the face. But actual on the actual gliding side, there weren't not too many. I know we had one when I was night flying at Bryce Norton. One of our lads, a private soldier, was sat in the doorway of the glider at night as it was being towed round from landing, towed round ready to take off again, and it hit a bump on the tarmac, on the taxi track. And he fell out of the glider and the wheels ran over him. That killed him.
Was the chap who was hit in the first killed?
Yes, yes. And we had Harry Ridgway. He was a friend of mine. He was in boy service with me. He was on flying gliders at Elsham Wolds. And he took off at night with a glider. And as it got airborne, it got into a turn, started to turn. And he tried to recover it. And as more he tried, the greater the turn. And in the end, it had to cast off. And it crashed. His co-pilot was killed. And he had broken leg and one or two injuries. And at first, they put the fault down to him, saying that it was because he was not fully trained and that kind of thing. It was his fault. He was not sufficiently capable of handling the situation. But... they eventually had to get a civilian lawyer to take this case to court, and they got really down to basics, and they found out, in fact, that when they'd been doing an inspection on this glider, they crossed the controls, the men on the ground, when they'd been rejigging the aircraft, the controls had been crossed, so that when he took off and the wing dipped, when he was trying to pick up that wing again, what he was doing, in fact, was just increasing the bank. And so eventually he was cleared of it.
You were telling me earlier off the record how you didn't get into operations in the Second World War.
No.
Can you repeat again what you were telling me then, please?
Well, at the time of the Arnhem operation, I was still at flying school. We flew at Denham, just across from Denham Studios, an airfield there. So I obviously was too late for the Arnhem operation. And the time of the Rhine Crossing, which was the next airborne operation, I joined the squadron that particular week that the operation took part, so I missed out on that one as well.
How did you feel about missing these operations?
The Arnhem operation, obviously I couldn't have done much about that because I was only just started my training, but I'd certainly like to have been available for the Rhine Crossing. I'd like to have done an operation. We were, in fact, sort of stood to a couple of times after that, but in both cases the ground forces were moving that fast over Europe that the operations were cancelled. And then I went to join a squadron for the Far East, what was going to be Tiger Force, for the invasion of Japan, and I was actually on embarkation leave when they dropped the atomic bomb, so that was cancelled, so I didn't go, didn't do that either. But no one went for that one, of course.
Now, you were also telling me that you were involved in the Berlin airlift, I think, was that 1948?
49? I think it was about that time. I shouldn't tell you from my logbook there. Yes, at the time of the Berlin airlift, I was stationed at Fairford, and we were flying Hamilcar gliders at the time, which were towed by Halifax aircraft, four-engined aircraft. And our crews were at that time in the process of converting onto Hastings, which was at that time a new aircraft just coming into service. And as they hadn't got second pilots, they contacted the glider pilot regiment and asked if we would like to go and fly as their second pilots, which of course we jumped at the chance, having a chance to fly four-engined aircraft. I was fortunate in so much as the pilot I was crewed up with, a chap named Jack Bowdler, was very keen, very conscientious pilot, and when I was crewed up with him, he asked me if I'd just come along for the ride or did I want to learn to fly. So I said I would like to fly, learn to fly, as he put it. And so after a while we took it turn and turn about. We did two trips a day to Berlin from Schleswig Bruce Station to Schleswig-Holstein, and he would fly the aircraft down, I would bring it back, then I would take it down on the next lift, and then he would bring it back. And of course we flew round the clock, working shifts and day and night. The organisation was absolutely incredible, the airlift, it was amazing.
In what way?
The number of aircraft. You could stand up and look through the Astrodome in the top of the aircraft, and as far as the eye could see, both behind and in front of you, would be a stream of aircraft at your own height. There'd be another one above you, so that 1,000 feet above you, and then as we got nearer to Berlin, there'd be another stream coming in from the south, and each stream was going to three different aircrafts. The Tempelhof, Gattau, and Tegel. We operated into Tegel, which was a French airfield. But of course they didn't really take part in the airlift. Gattau was an RAF airfield, and Tempelhof was run by the Americans, although all our controllers at Tegel were all American.
Sounds dangerous if so many planes were going in.
The timing had to be spot on, really. There was a danger. Once you'd landed, the idea was to unload and get airborne again as quickly as possible. Well, obviously, there was a time schedule for the aircraft to land, because this was controlled by the radar people who had you positioned out down, coming down on the lift. But takeoff was a bit of a gamble. And so what one did, as soon as you landed, the idea was you would trim the aircraft tail heavy so that you could taxi around as fast as you could to the unloading point. Before you'd switch the engines off, really, the doors were open, lorries were backed up, we were carrying coal. We were carrying 8 ton of coal on most of our lifts. The aircraft was unloaded. Before they'd finished unloading, we'd start the two engines on the opposite side to where the wagon was. And by the time the wagon was pulled away with them, we'd got all four engines going and we were off. Now, as soon as you got to the takeoff point again, it was just a case of holding there until there was a bit of a gap, and as soon as the gap, the controller would just shout, "Okay, away you go," and you would take off. Well, a friend of mine, Joe Toll, he was an army pilot, he was in one of the aircraft, and they'd done this, and they suddenly got the word to go. They took off, and the aircraft went straight up in the air, almost on its nose, stood on its tail. Cut the engines, of course, went straight down, crash, blew up, they were all killed. And when it came to the court of inquiry, it was found that the tail trimmer had still been set in the tail down position, and it was a very strong control. So obviously what had happened, as soon as it opened the engines, it had just gone up nose up, and they just couldn't control it, and it killed all four of them, all the crew.
That was at Teagle?
That was at Teagle.
Did you take anything else in apart from coal?
Once or twice we took in sort of general stores, shoes, flour, sugar, and we once took back, we actually, the actual lift actually flew in a power station into Berlin, and we one time flew one of the girders in, but for that we had to go to Gatow because of the, they'd got cranes and that to lift the thing in and out. And of course that was just a one day trip because it took so long to get the girder out of the aircraft again. But they actually flew in a complete power station, so everything was flown in. Pom was the main thing for the food, you know pom?
No.
Dried potatoes, you know, like you have this what mash, that
yes.
kind of thing. Well, it was called pom then. I think that was the diet of all the people in Berlin. It wasn't very pleasant, I gather.
What was the coal in?
In sacks. All in sacks. And it was chained to the floor. All chained down. We had Germans who did the unloading at either end.
Did it make a mess of the aeroplane?
When I flew out, we picked up a brand new aircraft. I joined the crew at Lynham. And we picked up a brand spanking new aircraft. It had done about 6 or 7 hours flying, that's all. And the next day, we flew the same aircraft down to Berlin with the coal on board. And when we came back, we were always nicknamed the Kentucky Minstrels because we were absolutely black. And of course, it got into the control runs and things like that. So couldn't get away from it. I mean, you only had to try to climb in the aircraft and sit down and you were covered in coal dust. Got everywhere.
This was a Hastings?
Hastings, yes. On the same airfield as we had two or three civilian companies. This is where a lot of the civilian people made their money. They bought up surplus RAF old bombers and things. They bought the Halifax. And they took the bomb bays out and put a tank there, called it a Halton, and they flew in diesel. Also, they had Liberator bombers, which did the same thing. They were flying diesel oil in. And Lancasters, which were converted again, they mainly flew in diesel oil. And we were at Teagle one day when I think it was a Halton came in, and he'd lost his undercart. He couldn't get his undercart down. And he got oil on board, diesel oil. So he had to make a belly landing. And he landed on the runway, and you can imagine all the sparks flying out, and it screwed across the grass. And before the aircraft had stopped, really, you saw all the hatches fly open, and all these little bodies come galloping out and running across. And we actually found out later that one of the chaps who'd come out of the top hatch had broken his ankle when he'd landed on the ground, but he'd run 200 or 300 yards to get away from the aircraft. But it didn't brew up as an actual fact. But we lost a few Holtons from Schleswig. Two or three crashed. Mainly, I think, because they didn't keep up the standard of servicing that was kept up by RAF people, of course. They were there for the money, because the more lifts they could do, the more money they were getting. So they were flying, taking aircraft which were certainly not serviceable, as far as the RAF people had been concerned.
Did this coal dust ruin the engines then?
Not to the engines. Wouldn't affect the engines. Wouldn't get to the engines. Because it would all be in the fuselage.
Did the Berliners seem grateful for
that? Oh, yes, yes, yes. Yes, very much so.
What would they say to you?
We didn't see them often, but the general feeling was the fact that it was the airlift that was keeping them going. There is a monument now at Tempelhof, with it's just like a large monument with three columns showing the three routes into Berlin, and they've got the names of those who died on the airlift on it. Joe Toll's name is on that. The people who were killed on the lift.
Did Russian aircraft ever buzz you?
Yes, we buzzed a couple of times. They used to do air-to-ground firing in the corridor in the attempt to put you off. But we carried on, but two or three times we were buzzed by, not actually buzzed, but they sort of came above you and then dived down in front of you and then started firing at targets on the ground. But we got our own back one morning. It was one Sunday morning, very early on. We took off from Tegel, and we'd not been airborne very long, and we saw this old Russian biplane staggering out of their airfield. And so my skipper, Jack Bowley, shouts, the enemy. And he went for it, sort of dived underneath it, and then came up in front of it with four engines and opened them up full blast. So I should imagine that gave him a bit of a shaker in his aircraft.
Any other incidents that stick out in your mind from the Berlin airlift days?
No, I don't think so. The actual control of it and the main amount of aircraft in the air at the time, the organisation, was absolutely incredible. And of course the flying had to be more or less spot on, so that you were arriving over at your various points at the exact time you're supposed to. So it was a masterpiece of organisation. I believe they called on two American colonels who'd been organising the airlift over the hump in India to China, and I think they were largely responsible for a lot of the organisation.
How long were you personally doing it for?
About 6 months.
What was the Hastings like to fly?
Lovely. Lovely aeroplane. Yes, very, very nice.
Now, was the next thing the Malayan Emergency that you were involved in as far as active service was
concerned?
Yes. Can you tell me how you came to be involved in it?
Well, it was at that time, 1950, it was decided that gliders were a spent force and they weren't going to be used anymore. So they ran the regiment right down then. But the idea was they would keep on about 20 crews, and they would be kept for coup de main operations. This was the idea. There would never be another thing like the Groen Crossing or Arnhem again, because we wouldn't have air superiority to put that many gliders in force. And then the AeroP organisation, artillery, started asking for if we would help them in Malaya, because they'd had a couple of flights out there and their demands were getting very heavy. And so they called on us if we would help them. So we did a small conversion course at Middle Wallop onto Osters. And then we went out to Malaya. Originally, we had a flight out there, independent flight, all glider pilots. And then the later on sent us out, and they had one glider pilot on each of the AeroP flights. I went to 1914 flight, which was at Seremban, a Paroi camp, and flew and joined the flight there. They're all AeroP officers apart from myself.
So the unit was called 1914 flight?
1914 AeroP flight, RAF. But it was 656 squadron. It was still controlled. The aircraft were owned, as it were, and maintained by the RAF. But the pilots were army.
But the squadron was 656?
656 squadron. Mm.
And what were the facilities like at Seremban?
We lived in bashes, made out of palm leaves, that kind of thing. Just bamboo and what was called atap. Just